8:13 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Board of Education meeting for the final time yesterday in the studio with a recap of that meeting, as well as some of the other ongoing issues. I have the superintendent of schools, Jill Gildea, along with business administrator Todd Hauber and school board member Aaron Grady. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start with the calendar. I had seen some concern on social media about next year's calendar. We're talking about the 2019-2020 calendar. My understanding is that you have received a lot of public input. You had two options for the school board then to discuss. Did you make a decision, Aaron?
No, it was actually not a decision-making item last night on the agenda. It was a discussion item, so we definitely had people come up and give us some more input on that and give us a little bit more feedback, and we're going to bring that back to the table in early January.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about that. There was some complaint, again, social media, who knows what's what, but just that they felt like there wasn't a lot of input into what was being proposed. Where did these ideas come from?
We actually have a committee that's formed. It has members from the PCEA on it, community members, business admin. So people within the district that kind of came up with the two different versions that have been seen out on social media. There was also a survey that was put out, and it came back that B version was a more desirable version, at least from within the district.
So can you kind of outline what that B version looks like?
Let's see if these guys can help me too, if I can remember. So right now it looks like starting 2 days earlier than we would have this year. We lose 1 day over our UEA or fall break. So just having that Friday off. The B version gives us actually 2 full weeks at Christmas time, as opposed to coming back on that Thursday and then here Thursday and then a half a day Friday. And then the B version takes us into early June, where the A version would have gotten us out right around Memorial Day weekend.
All right. So I guess, where did the idea then come from? I mean, was it something that your input, Jill? Or, I mean,
no,
the calendar committee just wanted to do something new?
Right, it's the committee. So every year you have to adjust slightly those 180 days based on where different holidays fall. So basically you're looking at an annual calendar. You're looking at 180 school days that the kids will have. And you just look at, you know, where are those natural breaks? Where do the semesters fall? The idea for this, obviously, is that when you have concurrent enrollment classes for your high school kids, they're matching a UVU calendar. So they're and they're responsible for that content, whether or not we're in school. The athletic system begins earlier across the whole state. So our kids are actually competing before they're actually students for the year. So that's interesting. But the big driver was really the mental health and wellness of taking an actual break in your semester before you leave for the holidays, rather than coming back for a week or two and then having semester exams.
And that was interesting, because you did hear from the student board representative saying that he's not sure that all kids would like that, that there are some who want those holidays to prepare for that end of semester training. So do you have to take a survey of the students to figure that out? I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right? Take a break, be done, but
yeah. Yeah, so when you look at universities, you know, they have you end before you leave for break. They do have you take all of your exams first, especially if you're dealing with pretty high-intensity content, as our kids are. So, but yes, we will look at a parameter survey sometime right after the new year. So that will be a broad-based community stakeholder survey. So that will include parents, students, staff, and we'll try to set kind of those expectations, you know, when you start, the preference for a 1 or 1.5 or 2 week winter break. So we'll try to gather that feedback as we do future planning then.
Mm-hmm. It seems like, and Todd, maybe you're the historian on this one, that we used to do these calendars further out as opposed to the year before, just to give families a chance to plan ahead.
Yeah, and there's been a variety of how far out that was, whether it was a year out, 2 years out, 3 years out. And there's just, it's a flexible thing that happens as the committees are pulled together and do their work.
All right. So, I mean, is there some talk then maybe that we do extend, give people a more than a year?
Yes, absolutely. We definitely heard that loud and clear last night, and I think it's definitely board direction to move forward that way.
Okay. Is it only these two options, or will there be reconsideration for something else based on what you heard yesterday?
There has been, I think, a little bit of talk, too, about maybe keeping the calendar exactly or very similar to the way it fell this year. So that would be the third option. But overall, they're all within a few days of each other. So
okay. But you expect to have this back on the agenda in January?
Yeah,
sometime?
I think early. Yeah, January.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about school fees there. Park City School District, really ahead of its time here. Did you know this was coming, Todd? So said we're gonna have to do it anyways, let's just do it?
Actually, we were on the cutting edge, if you will, before the debates were happening at the school board and at the legislature. We were having discussions with the city even with regards to social equity and what we can do to help students gain access to classes and not be economically discouraged from attending classes. So we had those conversations way ahead of the audits even as they were coming. The audits then caught up with our conversations and then exceeded or passed up where we were as a school district. We've only taken on the academic fees at this point. We still have extracurricular fees and co-curricular fees to look at as well. And so this guidance coming from the state board and from the legislature will help those conversations as well.
Now, is it still being considered at the state level? Whether or not these fees are...
Oh, absolutely. So right now, a task force has submitted what they recommend the rule changes to be. The state board will now take up those recommendations and determine which ones will become rule and which ones will not. And obviously, the legislature will look at that as well and determine whether it's gone far enough and the safeguards are in place for access to schools.
So whose decision is it finally, the legislature's or the school board?
It'll be the school board's rule, but the legislature always enjoys taking a look at what the board does.
Okay. So maybe you can just give us an update then in terms of what we did here. We just eliminated all academic fees, and yet kids still have to pay extracurricular fees.
Correct. So fees that used to be the book fee or the student fee or the arts class fee or the shop fee or the fees for different science classes, things like that. All of those fees were eliminated as far as students and parents having to pay, but the school board set aside funding out of its own funds to cover the costs of those classes. So it was just that academic portion, that portion that had to do with gaining credits towards graduation and things of that nature. The extracurricular, so whether you're in sports or debate, cheerleading, things of that nature, those fees are still all in place.
And there are fee waivers for those who may want to participate.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So band and dance, those are extracurricular?
Correct, and all subject to the fee waivers.
So for those of us who've had kids go through the school system and have paid the hundreds of dollars, any chance for a rebate?
Not that I'm aware of. Good idea, though.
Now, I think, what did we do? We had to institute a tax increase. I mean, it was about $1 million, right?
Sure. Yeah, we were already in the mode of looking at a tax increase because of the compensation packages that were coming through, as well as additional staffing. So it was part of that conversation. It was about $690,000 is what we budgeted for this school year.
All right. And then going forward, we will just kind of wait to hear what the legislature does in terms of any extracurricular changes?
Correct. Yeah. We'll see how firm those rules are from the school board, and then we'll reflect those in our own policies.
All right. Let's see. In your report to the board, Dr. Gilday, you mentioned the survey going out on guiding principles. Can you talk to me about what that is?
Certainly. So that's part of the master educational plan process, which we're in the midst of this time of the year, which is exciting. We have a large group of educators and community members coming together on that. So they about 125 people worked on 6 guiding principles of future of education. So these include the learning environment, they include safe, supported youth, they include inclusivity, and those aspects are going to be surveyed among the broader community for a level of importance, and then anything we might have missed in those guiding principles. That then becomes a part of the master educational plan as we look at the future, roadmap for Park City School District. So it sets any of those design principles against those aspirational values of the community.
So a survey, as my understanding, has already gone out. Do you have the results of that survey? And this would be a second survey?
So the first survey we did were three critical skills for Park City School District graduates. And that survey came back, and it did have all of those things you might expect. Our 21st century skills, we call them. Critical thinking, good communication, collaboration. Those are the themes that came through that we really need to have not only academically prepared kids, but kids ready for life.
So when you have those answers to that, how does that affect what you do with a master plan?
So the idea of setting the course for the master education plan is you're really talking about a transformation map of the future. What does education look like today, and what will it look like 10 years from now? What is it that the community wishes for it from its schools? So this sets the course for that. Then when we look at furniture, when we look at paint color, you know, we look at those things that have come through as the preferences from what we're hoping to achieve as a community, and we put all of our design principles against those.
So you expect to have a master plan done, Erin, in 2019?
Yes, in May. That's what we're kind of, I think the proposal is supposed to be coming to the board in May.
Right. So some of the components are these guiding principles that we're talking about. Then it goes into educational specifications for the different kinds of classrooms. So that's what the learning leaders were working on last night. So, you know, what does that mean for a seminar space, a laboratory space, a classroom or learning studio? So those kinds of things were fleshed out last night with lots of great visual images and actual descriptive lists. So indicators that we can measure against.
Yeah. So, I mean, as we're looking at this and we think, oh, I mean, this is what people want. I mean, do we know that it's the best way to educate a child?
Right. So all of that is being funneled through our experts, our educational experts, as well as external experts. So we have somebody working with us named Victoria Bergesell, who's well known across internationally, actually, for this type of work. And she actually started in schools, a teacher, a principal, got so into building and design, actually launched this professional consultancy that she does, and works with architects, works with school districts to make sure that what we're doing is indeed, you know, future focused.
Right. And I mean, part of it, we're talking about blended learning, using, you know, a student or a teacher up front, and then using internet related services. We're talking about project based learning. What are some, and we're talking about more CTE classes, maybe for the kids who aren't college bound but want a skill. I mean, what else is out there?
Right, all those kinds of things. So right now we are doing some really innovative things in Park City Schools, which I'm sure you're aware of. And one of those is kind of a blended learning class, for instance, at the high school. But right now that teacher, while the kids are doing most of their work outside the classroom and checking in with him, he has a full-size classroom. So what we're learning in future design, maybe not every room is the same shape or size. He doesn't need 30 seats in his room because the kids are coming in as needed for support, tutoring, mentoring, guidance, never really as a whole group. So this is what we're learning in these new models. It takes different kinds of spaces in order to achieve our goals.
Yeah, and then in this notion of project-based learning, I mean, some kids just don't like to be part of group projects. I mean, are there exceptions then for those kids?
I think there will always be choice. I think that's the best part of our public schools, is there are opportunities for small group, large group, independent work.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the upcoming organizational structure. And I think this is something you've been looking at. It was part of your superintendent's report. We're proposing to keep the business administrator the same, but we're looking at a chief academic officer as well as a chief operations officer. So are those two new positions or something that is farmed out to existing staff?
Those are actually, we're taking advantage of some retirements, and right now we have an interim associate soup of teaching and learning. So that position really will be rebranded, reformed as a chief academic officer. And then we have some retirements coming up. So using that opportunity, we'll reimagine, redesign for what I believe is a more streamlined approach. We really want academic excellence. That's our chief academic officer. We really want operational efficiency. That comes from our COO, who's really a lead project manager, who looks at safety security, who looks at the condition of the facilities and the grounds, and helps to direct that kind of work and get it organized and executed in a really efficient way.
Okay, so this would be like the Tim McConnell and the Kathleen Einhorn positions
Correct.
That we've had?
Correct.
Okay, so we're not talking about two new staff members then, Todd, to budget for?
No.
Okay. In terms of a diversity committee, you had mentioned that also. What does that look like?
Right. So I'm part of the actual Park City as a whole launched a partnership with the Park City Community Foundation, and they launched a social equity committee. So Abby McNulty from our Park City Ed Foundation and I serve as school representatives on that area-wide committee that's really looking at accessibility across all kinds of things. You know, really exciting work it looks like is going to come out of that committee. We're looking at workforce diversity, housing, childcare, you know, education opportunities. It's really good work in this community.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the wellness policy. You had about six people approach the board, one from PC Eats in support of it. The others asking the board to consider the bigger picture and how celebrations and activities can enhance learning, concerned about eliminating all food from the classroom. And that was part of the policy, not using food as a
Really a reward. I think that was the biggest thing in question, is that we were concerned about teachers like throwing basically candy and stuff at kids as rewards. As far as, I mean, I think we had a teacher come up and speak to us last night where she has a garden in her classroom and she's used the cilantro and taught the kids how to make salsa, and then they get to eat the salsa as a reward is very different than the throwing the candy. So we definitely listened to all the constituents. We kind of went back to the original verbiage, ended up going back to the original verbiage of the policy and kind of putting it back on the business administrators. But we did task the committee with that policy to kind of really look over that reward system and what it means for the different buildings across the board.
Okay, so it was voted on.
It was
voted
on.
3-2, so it was a split vote. Those against it were concerned about what?
Again, it comes back to that reward of the, I think our biggest concern was rewarding children with food.
Okay.
It has really been, I think, and please step in if you guys feel differently, but with the debate has been that reward system.
All right. So,
and just making sure we have, as far as classroom celebrations, that we're using, you know, having healthy options and smart choices for our children.
So the policy does allow that then as approved.
Yes, right. It will continue to allow that.
Okay. Finally, wanted to ask where we are. This was Petra Butler's last meeting as a school board member. What's the process for her replacement?
So we are in the process of taking applications. All applications go to Andrew Kaplan, and we're taking the applications through January 7th. And I do know that I believe we might have one or two applications already in. So the more interest, the better. I think it's great to get more community interest.
And I think you plan to interview?
Yes, we're looking at interviewing on, I believe, the 15th of January.
All right. Again, people can get more. There's something on the website in terms of how to apply.
Yeah, on the website, and then his email is on the website, but akaplan@pcschools.us.
Okay. Anything else that you need to mention?
This is a District 3 representative that we are looking to elect or appoint, and then they would be a two-year member. They could choose to then run again if they wish to continue their service.
Okay. Hey, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
8:32. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Council meeting for the final time of 2018 on Thursday. In the studio with a preview of that agenda, I have Park City Manager Diane Foster along with Special Events Manager Denny Dearson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see. Any updates with regard to DePauli, Samuels McLean?
No updates. She is still on unpaid leave.
Okay. Do you hope to figure that out by the end of the year? Or?
I don't have an exact timeline.
Okay. Let's see. The staff looking for direction from council on a plan to institute what is being called My Sustainable Year campaign. Before you were city manager, Diane, this was something that you did and worked with KPCW on, My Sustainable Year. How is this going to be different than what you did?
Most importantly to me is I'm not doing it. It was actually a lot of work, but there were a lot of people in the community and on the council who contributed to it. And the idea is that we engage with the community on behavior change. And so, for example, January is climate change, and there'll be something different, and we'll be communicating with the community. It's a, obviously, year-long campaign. And it's really talking to people about how things we do in life affect climate change. And so, you know, when I used to be part of a group, a nationwide group of sustainability managers, and what everyone in that basically industry talks about is that the hardest piece is behavior change. So Luke and Celia and team are working with Rocky Mountain Power along with the mayor to go 100% renewable electricity for the whole community. And they're on a good path for that. And Rocky Mountain Power has been a terrific partner. So we can do everything on that front, but still you still need behavior change. And also you need people to start thinking about when is the right time for them to buy an electric vehicle. I was talking to County Council member Kim Carson the other day, and she got a hybrid car. I recently traded in my Subaru that I kind of beat up when I was living in Tollgate and went to an electric car. And it's super fun to drive. And we were part of Subscriber Solar, so I've now moved to a zero carbon car. So lots of opportunities. February will be what can you do in your home month. March is energy. They'll be doing a month on how your health relates to climate change, food, air quality, stuff, right? Just buying things impacts climate change. And also in December, they'll be talking about environmental values. And also during the year, there'll be lots of exciting things and events going on as well.
So what's the idea? I mean, will somebody be doing like monthly presentations at the beginning of each month to get people on board? Or, I mean,
yes.
Do we know how the program works?
The absolute specifics, no. But I do know that we are going to engage with our media partners on that. So KPCW and the Park Record will be integral to that. And our team's getting out in front and having things like events that are already planned, getting out and talking to people in the community about the topic of the month. And just like we have Tri-Transit Week in, right now, encouraging people to try stuff out. I remember in my sustainable year talking with Summit Land Conservancy Director Cheryl Fox, and she had never taken the bus to Deer Valley before. And this is, I think, 6 years ago when we did my sustainable year. And she tried the bus to Deer Valley and found out it is the very best parking space you can get because it picks you up right in front of, drops you off right in front of Deer Valley. And you can take your skis on the bus. So we just, it's an opportunity for people to kind of get out of everyday habits and try something new.
Okay. Seeing a number of temporary liquor license approvals for the Sundance Film Festival, as well as convention sales. What are those? I mean, licenses for that?
Convention sales licenses are, do you want to talk to that actually, Jenny?
Yeah, so you're convention sales licenses are for those groups coming in that are not under the MFL, and so they need to get business licenses and inspections and permits in order to go into those brick and mortar spaces as they're changing those spaces. So that's what those licenses are for.
What are you seeing in terms of that? those subleases for a lot of the places on Main Street?
I'm sorry.
I mean, in terms of numbers, I mean, are they about comparable with what we've seen in the years past?
They are comparable with what we've seen in years past. To be honest, we are down in the number that we see historically at this point in the year, which means that likely over the next couple of weeks, we're going to get a flood of those. So if you are looking to rent a space out on the street, make sure you're in getting those permits. And we do have, and we've had the rules of the road up since August, actually. And so all of those parameters of what you need to do and how to do it are also on our website under the special events webpage.
Okay. And as I mentioned, temporary liquor license approvals have to be done for the city as well as the state, or just the city?
I believe that's also a state approval that they do. And then the city has to give what's called local consent.
Okay. And I don't know if you caught the front page paper of the New York Times yesterday about Utah's stringent new liquor law. Any response to that? Any concerns or discussion on a city level at this point?
I think police, right, just like all the other stuff, they will enforce state law. And I do think that one of the things that is maybe a little bit different in Park City is from other places is community policing. And so, for example, I read an article a few years back in the Salt Lake Tribune. It was a columnist that talked about the fact that there was a drunk guy during Sundance, and instead of putting him in jail, they put him in a taxi and send him home. So now that's different if you're driving. Obviously, that is not going to happen. They're not going to put you in a cab and send you home. However, just kind of regular people on the street who are maybe over imbibing, police treat a little bit differently.
Okay. The ice rink interlocal agreement, where are we with this?
This one, interesting. Council approved it, and the mayor asked council last week if they would be willing to call it up. The concern on the part of that the mayor expressed was that the city was increasing its contribution to the capital fund, which maintains all of the equipment and the facility at the ice rink, from $50,000 a year to $80,000 a year. And that was approved in the city council budget as well. Snyderville Basin said they couldn't match that, and the ice rink does have more people who participate from the basin, and it is a joint project. Even though the city runs it, people from outside the city have access to it, and so the request wasn't, the basin wasn't able to come to the table with an additional $30,000. And however, they have expressed, and thanks to Brian Hanton for expressing a willingness to consider individual projects as we go through the year. But I think the mayor said that might not be fair, and we should have a level playing field. So what Amanda Angevin has done is put together what are the things that we would have to cut if we don't do the additional $30,000 from the city. And there are some energy initiatives in there, some concrete paint, some essential equipment, and things like painting lines, right? Instead of doing that, they would reduce the frequency of doing that. So it's basic elements in there, and you know, staff is still recommending that we move forward with that. But at minimum, I think it's a good opportunity to discuss, hey, we should all be coming to the table with funding on this.
All right, so they'll just kind of get spread out, and then Basin Rec, if they have the money, could chip in it's done?
Could chip in, and I think Amanda Angevin and Brian Hanton have a great relationship, and they'll continue to work with the Snyderville Basin Rec Board on that as well.
Okay, Park City accepting the donation of Solomir Lot 61. How many acres are we talking about here?
I don't even know the acreage. I think it's somewhere between a quarter. It is around a quarter acre lot, but it is a lot that's around Telemark Drive and Solomir. And this is kind of a fun holiday present. This is a resident who lives across the street who also owns that, and her perspective was that it helped with her view shed. She's a little bit older now and has since moved down to Salt Lake. I believe her family's living in that house, and they wanted to maintain the view shed and thought that the city would be a good steward for it. So they want to donated to the city as open space. There is a, like many HOAs, there is a fee even if you haven't built on your lot. So there is a $900 a year fee that the property owner will donate that the first year, and then the city would have to pick up afterwards. And Heinrich Dieters is working with the HOA on, is there some public benefit that could be derived? Like, could there be meeting? Could we have meetings at the clubhouse, for example, or something like that, so there would be some public benefit. But I think at the end of the day, if you look and say, while this is a piece of open space that somebody could probably sell for somewhere between $700,000 and $1 million, given where it's located, actually it's probably worth more than $1 million, giving that to the city is probably worth the $900 a year and whatever we would have to pay for. We'd have to maintain the lot, so weed maintenance and things like that.
Okay, so you couldn't take it and build affordable housing on it?
We want to be consistent with the, and the resolution that City Council would pass in order to accept it would require that it be maintained in its natural state as open space.
All right. Let's turn to you, Jenny. The supplemental plan for Sundance doesn't look like a whole lot's changed since the current year for next year, except that, New Frontier will now be housed in that old Blockbuster space next to Walgreens now?
Yeah, that is one of the major changes of the Sundance Film Festival. You know, I have to mention that Sundance is such an incredible opportunity for our community, and you know, both the economic and cultural benefits that Sundance and their team work so hard to provide to us year-round is really wonderful. So there are minor changes. Last year, we made some major changes, specifically with regards to transportation, and much of that is the same. But for Sundance, it is a new venue. So next to the Walgreens, it's the new Frontier Central. We're looking forward to this new space. So some of the activities that they were doing at the Kimball Art Center last year will now be in this new space that's just adjacent to that Walgreens. And it also continues to help provide walkability and connectivity between the venues, whether that's in the theater district where the Ray is, closer walkability in different points between Main Street and the library, and then also the Eccles Theater. So lots of great work there. And then also some slight changes to the lift operations, a new drop and load location down on Lower Main Street, which is something particularly the merchants and the restaurants down there are looking forward to. And that's really to help with a pickup location so people don't have to come all the way up middle of Main Street, and also help with transportation flow. And then just a mention of the Festival Village setup starting on January 18th. That's Friday, January 18th. And then also there will be a concert of some kind on the 26th, which is that Saturday, and that'll go until 11 o'clock. And Sundance continues to work very closely with us on noise and sound mitigation for activities like that. And then I want to mention, throughout last year's event with so many changes, and then also throughout the summer with events, we've been working really hard on community outreach and debriefing and understand whether it's a business owner or employee or a resident, how to make tweaks or little changes to what we did last year to try and make it better. So while much of the things are the same, China Bridge is one of the things that will be changing, and those hourly rates or those parking rates will be $40 flat rate for the first 5 days of the festival. So that's the Thursday through Monday. And then based on a lot of feedback, we're going to be trying a $5 an hour rate the second half of the festival. It will be a max of 40, but that's to help bring people back to Main Street to patronize some of the businesses the second half of the festival. And that'll start at 11 o'clock in the morning. So that second half, if you need to come up and get your mail, get a cup of coffee, run a quick errand on Main Street, that'll be the best time to do that.
Okay, so that goes 11 to 11?
It'll go 11 until 2 a.m. And then again, at that max rate of $40 an hour. And then great things, I think Richardson Flat will continue running throughout the entire festival, all 10 days. That was a huge deal last year that'll continue. And then also residential mitigation, like we saw last year, specifically in the Old Town area and some other areas around town, will continue. And then Alfred and his team, Caroline, out in the county, and our transit team here, they've done a ton of year-round improvements. So rather, that's the new TCC, that's the Traffic Control Center. The Camas commuter is now extended 7 days a week, and the list kind of goes on there, lots of details in that report. But these are the things we're looking to do to make year-round improvements and continued improvements throughout the event.
All right. Let's see, that Richardson Flat. So we're going to have shuttle buses going between there and where?
They're in the high school, so that's that is the loop, and that'll be running from 7 a.m. to 3 a.m. throughout the festival. That's the Thursday through the second Saturday.
And in terms of that, we've got some events taking place out at the film studios. I'll be talking about one of those. I mean, are we going to have a bus going there, or can that Richardson Flat stop at the...
The Richardson Flats bus does not stop there, and that's due to efficiency reasons. So Sundance is working on a shuttle system for those people going to that event, and also making sure that there's enough parking at the studio for those activities as well.
All right. And then with regard to the lift being on Lower Main Street, so are you saying that if somebody hires a Lyft or Uber, can't get a ride to Egyptian Theater?
They can still go onto Main Street, but it's just a better parking location. And again, trying to keep most of the traffic or the traffic down there, and then they would actually loop out onto Deer Valley Drive and come up on Swede to try and reduce some of that traffic on Main Street.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention about that?
I don't. I just appreciate everyone's continued feedback, and we do have a very busy winter ahead of us, and thank you for everyone's feedback.
Yeah, real quick though, with regard to the World Championships, are we going to have a street concert then? That's that Saturday. Let me see. It ends the 3rd, so on the Friday or Saturday before.
So we are hosting closing ceremonies on Main Street, and so that'll be on February 10th. So that's a week after the Sundance Film Festival ends.
Okay. That's kind of when we're going to have the street dance then planned.
Yes.
All right. And then library board meeting today, my understanding, to consider ending those overdue book fines? Do you know about that?
So I believe the library has already recommended that, and City Council has approved that resolution. So I believe in January we will be going fine-free, and that is a wonderful social equity. Until I heard about Salt Lake Library director talk about how people don't go to the library sometimes if they're at lower income and they're afraid that their kids aren't going to return books. And also we've learned that fines actually don't work and that you can simply send people reminders. And if somebody never brings back a book, they will still have to pay for the book.
Okay. Diane, Jenny, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:55. Coming up on January 24th, the Sundance Institute presents the 10th annual Artist at a Table. In the studio with details, I have Josie McGuinn, the events director for Sundance Institute. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about the event. I mean, everyone's invited to buy a ticket. It's not cheap, though.
Yes, that's correct. So as you said, it's our 10th year and we're celebrating an artist at the table this year. And you can purchase tickets online. You can reach out to me, and all of the funds that support all the funds that are raised through this support independent artists, and they go to grants, mentorships, and critical resources that help bring their stories to life.
Okay, so the event kicks off with the opening film at the Eccles Center. I think that 5 o'clock screening, or
yes, 5:30 screening at Eccles, and it is a world premiere of After the Wedding. It's a mesmerizing retelling of Susan Beer's Academy Award nominated Danish film, and the electrifying cast will showcase a mysterious unraveling of events ignited by an invitation to a wedding.
Okay, so from there, then you shuttle everybody who's been part of this to the Utah Film Studios, a new location for you.
Yes, so we are in a new location and very excited about this. Many unexpected pieces that are going to unravel at this event. And the space will accommodate upwards of 500 guests this year, if not more. And our tickets are selling fast. Tables are selling fast as well. There's a lot of energy and excitement around the event. We'll have over 50 artists at the event this year. It'll be a seated dinner and a program that is all centered around artists.
Okay. So maybe Amy joining us is Amy Redford. She's a director of her own right and then part of this organization. Tell us a little bit about just the concept of the artist at the table.
You know, it's one of my favorite things that goes on in the festival, because there's so much going on during that time period that you get to actually ground yourself with actual artists that make the films. So you are sitting at a table and you're like, oh, hi, Boots Riley, tell me about what your next film is. Or hi, person who's, you know, terrified and excited, and someone you haven't necessarily heard of yet, but you might over the next coming year, and you get to a little bit of insight into their process. And it's nice to reconnect to why we're all here, which is really about the filmmakers and about the authenticity of their stories. So it's kind of a really rare opportunity to be able to really dive in to these artists while you're hearing, you know, music, while you're having some food, you're getting to know people you're going to run into on the bus or the street or waiting in line. I think it's really a great opportunity.
Yeah. So do you have the list of artists at this point? You know who's coming?
We do. We're still securing artists up until days before, but we have an incredible lineup of artists that touch on all of our different programs. Amy, do you want to?
Yeah, I mean, right now, I think we, you know, among some of the people that are coming are Glenn Close and Ava DuVernay and Nancy Ford and John Hamm, Lisa Crone, Billy Luther. I mean, there's so many, you know, and it's great because the films have just been announced. So, you know, now we're being able to reach out to people officially and invite them to come participate. And, you know, you can really get a sense of how much having their films into the festival means to them. It's always such an uphill battle. It takes so much tenacity to get your film completed. And then to have it get to the festival is really a life-changing event. And you can actually feel it when you're sitting next to them at that moment. So,
okay. This is, as you mentioned, it's a fundraiser for the Institute. I think probably your biggest.
Yes, it is our largest annual fundraiser.
Yeah. So, again, if people are interested, they can go online and buy tickets.
Yeah, you go
there.
Onto the Sundance Institute website and to benefit events, and you can purchase online, learn about all the different ticket and table package options, or you can reach out directly to me at Sundance.
Okay. Real quick, Amy, before we join the news here, you were the featured artist at the Kimball Arts Center's Art Talk this week, yesterday.
Yes,
maybe.
I was last night.
Yeah, what was the presentation on?
It was really about my journey back to Utah and my enthusiasm for the film community here and sort of giving a really good insight into why Utah, why now. There's so many different organizations that are kind of galvanizing the film community, and I'm a real fan of the incentives that we have here, and boy, isn't it nice to be able to, you know, plan your film and then get on the slopes in 15 minutes. So I've just moved back in August with my family, and it's really been a wonderful opportunity. It's the state is just percolating with inventiveness right now.
Yeah. We've talked to your brother James about a couple of films that he's brought to Sundance, but you've had films in the festival
as
well?
My first feature debuted here, which was really a great opportunity and equally terrifying. And now I've just been very involved with the Institute and supporting their programs.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about just your dad? I mean, he's had some influence on your directing, and neither you nor Jamie got into the acting part.
You know what? I'm actually an actress in recovery. I was an actor for like 20 years on the stage in New York. But my heart really lies in directing. I started a film company here with Katie Bettner called Bette Red Stories, and we're going to produce all of our content out of Utah. I have a film shooting in Southern Utah, and I'm going to use mainly Utah talent. I've always been influenced by the strategy and approach and methodology that my dad uses in his filmmaking. I really admire the way he approaches not only the crew, but the actors and the stories he likes to tell. So having that kind of mentorship for, I think, both my brother and I has been incredibly meaningful, but of course we're our own people. So it's kind of hard to compare.
Okay. I need to leave it there. Amy and Josie, thanks for your time this morning.